We heard both Thoreau and Emerson speak to the way that nature can be a tonic, a medicine for our spirits when they feel weary or sad or ailing in some way. And I'm sure that we can all agree that we've all experienced that many times and that we return to nature as they did. For healing, for solace, for perspective. But what about us in our time? When sometimes the very beauty of nature, its remoteness, and all the ways it is different from our own lives remind us that it's in danger. This is a torment that the transcendentalists did not have to suffer. Thoreau was disturbed enough about the mark of humanity on the woods and mountains, how we turned pristine wilderness into oat fields, seeing wilderness only as a resource for our use and exploitation. I hate to think what he would be feeling now, although I wish we had his leadership at this moment. And it's not that he thought that we should live on roots and berries. He understood the necessity for oat fields. One of his lesser known accomplishments was to discover a better way, to develop a better way to get the graphite into pencils for the manufacture of wooden pencils. So he certainly saw the uses of trees and even participated in the felling of them. But he craved wildness. Seeing in it the preservation of the world, in his famous phrase, picked up and repeated by John Muir, as in wilderness is the preservation of the world. And I'm sure both of them would assent, in wildness and wilderness are the preservation of our souls as well. So, what would the early transcendentalists say if they could know how desperately the world needs preservation now? And what do we do when being in nature brings us so much bitterness along with the sweetness? The central teachings of transcendentalists are varied. They don't always agree on everything. They weren't so much a school of thought as a cluster of friends, of people of mutual influence. They did not try to bring their philosophies all into agreement. But in general, it can be said that Emerson, Thoreau, Fuller, Alcott, and that whole circle of mostly Unitarians of the early 19th century in this country believed these things: a deep trust in the individual spirit, a belief in the importance of our nonconformity. If each of us is to develop into our full selves and to be of full service to the rest of humanity and the earth, we need to follow our own intuition and inner wisdom. The improvability of humanity, not only individually, but as a whole. Thus, it's not surprising that the transcendentalists were very often on the cutting edge of social movements such as feminism and the abolition of slavery. John Burens, the Reverend John Burens, spoke to us just about a year ago in his class, in a class he led on the transcendentalists as activists. They all shared a skepticism toward received wisdom, whether it was in religion or some other area of thought. They were very much inheritors of the Enlightenment and also had a skepticism even of the reason and logic that the Enlightenment urged us to turn on everything that we learn. And very importantly, they believed, although they put this in many different ways, in the divinity of nature and the centrality of nature, all the world, all of the universe that is outside and beyond human existence. Now, It's interesting that they're called transcendentalists because, if you'll tolerate a little philosophical sideline here, in some sense that evokes transcending the known reality to attain something greater. It's the implication that what is divine or most real is not what we see or touch or taste or hear, but something purely spiritual beyond that. Now, I don't want to make too much of the name transcendentalist. It was kind of more thrust upon them than actively coined by them. And in any case, as I said, transcendentalists vary quite a bit in their philosophy. But they did generally agree to adopt the name. They called themselves the Transcendentalist Club when people started calling them that rather disparagingly. And Emerson in particular was explicit. By transcendentalism, he meant they were the direct heir of idealists. Idealism, the being the philosophy, well, think all the way back to Plato and his parable of the cave. The idea that what we are seeing around us is just shadows cast by reality. We see trees, but that's not the essence of tree. The essence of tree is something purely immaterial and beyond our perception, and so on. So what our senses detect is just a symbol or an outward sign of what's real and holy, the real thing, the ideal. On the other hand, if you follow transcendentalist thought, I get a theology very much like the divine is not something beyond nature, up above or existing before this world. What is most real is right all around us, within ourselves and the things that we can sense through all our senses. It's the real, the alive, the spiritual, the divine, all or any of those words. Those things are within nature and part of it and emerging from it. In other words, transcendentalism is less a transcendental philosophy than an immanental philosophy. Immanent with an A, meaning the divine is within everything, not beyond. Maybe that's why I'm drawn to Thoreau, not just because I like his writing style, but because he seems to enter entirely into nature for itself. He was a great naturalist. Scientists of his time and after his time looked back to his very close observations about nature. He wasn't interested in nature just as a sort of symbol or a means of thought or a way of discovering some truth beyond it. Although all of that was a part of what he got from exploring the woods and the rivers. But he also just seemed to be an immanentist, to see the very divinity right through and within the very particularity of whatever he was observing. Now, this is mostly a digression, I suppose, because where nature is concerned, the message of transcendentalism, as we read these folks again and again, seems to be that what we need to do is to enter more deeply into nature, that is, into the world. Not seek only through it to what lies beyond, but to delve deeply into nature itself and let it infuse us. Maybe that's what Amy Beltane is particularly thinking of when she writes this. There are these wonderful books collected in recent years by Skinner House, our in-house publisher. This one is called Pagan and Earth-Centered Voices in Unitarian Universalism. There's humanist voices in Unitarian Universalism, Christian, Jewish, LGBT, etc. Amy Beltane is a UU minister and pagan. She says, some of our American Unitarian forebears, especially transcendentalists, believed awe to be more important than reason, creativity more important than theory, action more important than contemplation, and the artist to be the epitome of civilization. You could call UU pagans neo-transcendentalists. I think, though, she would also agree with my slight twist on that, that perhaps we are, when we're being following a pagan path or just immersing ourselves in nature, whether or not we call ourselves pagans, we're being neo-immanentists. Because she says that one of the things that we learn in earth-centered spirituality, when we delve not into a irrational, but a pre-rational or non-rational form of knowing, something that carries us beyond what reason and logic and science can tell us to embrace a wider view. One of those things is a very immanent view. She says, the divine is within us and surrounds us, an immanent and intimate concept of divinity. These are the things when we learn not, these are the things we learn when we, as she says, don't return to childish things or reject science, but delight in the mystical, in nature, in play, in non-rational knowing and ancient wisdom, the same middle path that the transcendentalists sought to walk. This is where nature can take us. And yet, so often, we are returned to that heartbreak. Well, let's sit a moment with what happens when we immerse ourselves in the natural world, whatever that may mean to us, wherever we may best find it. It can be in a spectacular place like Yosemite. As I said, John Muir was an admirer of the transcendentalists, and you see their echoes in his writing and exploration. Or it can be as close at hand as the fur on your dog's ears, or the shriveled leaf of a houseplant on your table, or right there on your own hand. What we find when we go into nature with our scientific and logical exploration, hard at work, but also open to all other ways of perceiving and knowing, I can't put it into words. Thoreau did it as well as anyone, and he said it was impossible to put into words. But you know. So I want to give you just a moment to remember, or even to look around you right now and recall to yourself what happens when you really allow yourself to remember nature, when you allow nature to remind you of the universe of which you are a part. Can you remember? Can you feel it? This problem of feeling how vulnerable things are, it can drive us in different directions when it comes to our relationship to nature. It could make us cling miserably to them. And if being in nature makes us too miserable, then we will start to avoid it. We will start to fear even that experience of immersion because it comes along with grief and the fear of loss. Or knowing the vulnerability of nature could help us to immerse ourselves, to lose ourselves. Likewise, losing ourselves might be able to help us overcome our fear and grief enough to experience what the transcendentalists in a simpler world wrote about. Return us to that original relationship to the rest of the natural world, which we've so often lost. There is a developer of a a theory of faith development named James Fowler. He spoke of six stages of faith. And the sixth stage is one he believed very few humans ever attain. So let's try to be just fully developed humans and think about the fifth stage, which in Fowler's view was an ability to recognize that paradoxes exist, to grow in our ability to hold contradictory experiences, such as complete joy and fulfillment in being in the natural world, and grief and worry about nature and the challenges that we, one species, are posing to this great and complex organism of Earth. Fowler identifies the fifth phase as one in which, to use nature as one example, we would not shy away from the beauty of the world because its endangerment grieves us, nor would we deny its endangerment because we want pure, simple enjoyment, but we would be able to just be there fully. And here too, the transcendentalists are instructive. Margaret Fuller urged us, basically, let's see if I can find my quote here, to live fully in that way. She wasn't so much of a nature writer herself, but oh, how her attitude toward life helped us when we are feeling divorced from our roots. She and Emerson were great friends, and they challenged one another because they had a very different approach to life. Here's Emerson speaking possibly his most famous passage from his book-length essay, Nature. "Standing on the bare ground, my head bathed by the blithe air and uplifted into infinite spaces, all mean egotism vanishes. I become a transparent eyeball. I am nothing. I see all. The currents of the universal being circulate through me. I am part or particle of God." Even in this immersion, Fuller found him a little head-centered, and Emerson can be, not least in the difficulty of his language. She teased him a little. "You are intellect. I am life," she said. But she also really challenged him and us to let go. "Your prudence, my wise friend, your prudence allows too little room for the mysterious whisperings of life." I think that ultimately this is the teaching that our most precious Unitarian forebears, the transcendentalists or the immanentists, if I can call them that, I think this is what they teach us, to be open to the mysterious, to be open to things that life has to teach us that we just don't know yet. And that's a big risk. We're invited when we go out into the natural world, or when we look closely, even at the grain of wood on the furniture right here under our fingertips or any other place, that we see the workings of the natural world, the way a mote of dust in our room catches the sunlight and glows. Any place at all. If we're willing to let go and to take a risk, then we will hear the mysterious whisperings of life there. And here we come back around to Emerson. When I read this passage of his, at some moments I'm filled with grief when he writes, "There, when contemplating nature, he means, there I feel that nothing can befall me in life. No disgrace, no calamity leaving me my eyes, which nature cannot repair. And those who no longer have their sight would, I am sure, tell Emerson, you know, nothing can befall me in life, which nature cannot repair either. When despair for the world grows in me, as Wendell Berry writes, when despair for the world, for this beautiful earth, of which we once thought ourselves stewards, but of which we may be the destroyers and have destroyed so much of beauty. When that despair grows in me, it seems to me the transcendentalists here are saying, go further, go deeper, let nature repair you. Don't be afraid of how we may harm nature and it may need to repair itself. Just keep going. Because when we allow the currents of the universal being to circulate through us, we may feel that nothing can befall us in life. Nothing can befall us. Nothing can befall this world or this universe, which nature cannot repair. I hope it can be so. May we know it to be so.